From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and we continue now with our coverage of today's inauguration as we are joined by our two regular political commentators.
They are E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution and David Brooks of the New York Times. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And first, just reaction to today's message. First, David Brooks, what do you think?
An eloquent speech, sort of the most full-throated expression of American exceptionalism we've heard from a president for quite a long time. This is a tradition that really starts with Lincoln or maybe Walt Whitman. Goes through Woodrow Wilson, Reagan, JFK to his own extent, the idea that America has this exceptional role to be a champion of freedom until freedom is universal, which was once a radical notion but is something the president firmly believes in. And then in domestic policy, a sort of also a return to Lincoln. He mentioned the GI Bill, the Homestead Act, which was passed under Lincoln, and Social Security, sort of aggressive use of government, not libertarian, but aggressive use of government to give people the tools to run their own lives.
E.J. Dionne, were you hearing those same echoes there?
Not exactly. I mean, to give him credit, both David and I agree on one thing, which is we admire Mike Gerson, the president's speechwriter who's stepping down, and there were some very nice lines in this speech. We do not accept the existence of permanent tyranny because we do not accept the possibility of permanent slavery, and no one is fit to be a master, and no one deserves to be a slave. Very Lincolnian. I think the problem with this speech is that he presented the president an expansive vision of America's role in the world without saying anything about how he would do it. And Don Gagne earlier mentioned that the president didn't mention a specific word, which was Iraq. And I think it would have been helpful in calling people to this great crusade if he might have expressed even a smidgen of, well, this didn't quite go exactly as I planned. And I think if this vision means another Iraq or two, a lot of Americans will fall by the wayside, even though they support, in another nice Mike Gerson phrase, the expansion of freedom in all the world.
Let me ask you both this. When the president said, as he did today, those of you who live in tyranny and hopelessness can know the United States will not ignore your oppression or excuse your oppressors. When you stand for liberty, we will stand with you. In practical terms, David, do you think this means that we are now behind democracy advocates in everywhere from Beijing to Iran to Turkmenistan? We're going to back them as we did in Ukraine?
Yeah, the question is how aggressively. Does it mean we're going to break off relations with China? I think the scripting of the speech was careful not to say that. But I think if you take two countries, Iran, where we have been vociferously against the government there, we're incredibly popular because we are clearly seen on the side of liberty. In Egypt, where we support the government and sent them $60 billion, we're incredibly unpopular because we support the government. And I think this does go back to Reagan, the idea that you shouldn't play footsie with dictators. If you take a simple, stupid notion that we're on the side of the Democrats, we'll be on your side verbally, we won't always take the most aggressive action where it's not realistic. But that's the smartest thing to do rather than try to fine-tune every single one of these policies.
EJ?
Well, Robert, I think your question is the essential one, which is these words about liberty are quite wonderful. Will we apply them to Russia or to China or to Saudi Arabia? Or will we only support this when it's convenient but mouth the words in a speech? And in fairness, I think we've got to go back before Reagan. Jimmy Carter was really the president who made human rights a central focus of American foreign policy, and it has been a controversial focus. There was a time when a lot of Republicans were critical of Jimmy Carter for making human rights a focal point of American foreign policy. So this speech contains such a large promise that the president is really is going to be held accountable for a very grand vision of the America's role in the world.
Do you both agree, by the way, with the president's premise that the survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands? Or can we do quite well if some parts of the world are not governed democratically?
Well, I do happen to believe that we're in a war with extremist ideologies, this Islamic extremism, that this war is somewhat parallel to the war, to the Cold War, World War II, which I think are controversial notions, but I agree with the president essentially about those things. And so we are under threat unless we somehow defeat those ideologies. The one part where I do agree with EJ is he laid out this broad vision but didn't really address the problematics of it. And I would say those problematics come in two things. One, what are the institutions of government we need to carry out a policy of liberty? What size army do we need, for example? Two, in Iraq, we've got excessive liberty. We've got chaos. How do we impose order and authority, which used to be conservative words? And I think the president sort of exaggerates the freedom and underplays law and order and authority.
I thought I did hear at least an allusion, if not a specific reference to Iraq, when the president talked about the soul of a nation finally speaking and the institutions that arise may reflect customs and traditions very different from our own. That, to me, sounded like tamping down of expectations for the results of the Iraqi elections this month, EJ.
Well, I think he was trying to say that it will be a Muslim democracy, not a Christian democracy or a secular democracy or a Jewish democracy, and it will have its own characteristics, if we're lucky, if it goes in that direction. On the general point, I think the idea that the expansion of liberty in the world is good for our own liberty is a very old liberal idea. Certainly, it's a Franklin Roosevelt sort of idea. I think the question comes down to the practical choices Americans make. Americans don't want to go to war in one country after another. Invading Iran would not be popular. Invading Syria would not be popular. And so the question is, yes, we all want to expand liberty, but what are the means and what can we learn from the big mistakes we have made in Iraq?
But this is a debate that was not over. This speech was supposed to end a debate. The debate was between the realists, people like Brent Scowcroft and Henry Kissinger, who believe you shouldn't worry about democracy, just your narrow national interest, and the idealists. And this speech was designed to say our ideals are perfectly in line with our interests. And so to end that debate.
And in about 2 days or less, we're going to hear the realists strike back and say, fine, we all like freedom, but how do we do this? And so I don't think this ends the debate. I actually think it opens the debate for the next 4 years about what the United States' role in the world really is.
Just casting forward a little bit, I think it was inescapable when you watched Chief Justice Rehnquist deliver the oath not to think about the future of the Supreme Court. And David, I was struck by the poll in the New York Times today, one statistic in there that 43% of the people polled expect most forms of abortion to be illegal within 4 years, given expected appointments to the Supreme Court. What do you make of that in the future of the court?
Well, I think they misunderstand what happens if Roe v. Wade is overturned. A, I think that's unlikely. B, I think if Roe v. Wade is overturned, in most states, some forms of abortion will be legal. I think the idea that a Supreme Court fight is going to side rail the entire second term is a wrong one. I asked people in the first Bush administration, you know, they had bitter fights over Supreme Court nominations. Did this derail all the other stuff you were trying to do? And they said, no, it was weirdly compartmentalized. We had these bitter fights, but we still had domestic and foreign policy going off on separate tracks.
There are two interesting choices. One for Bush, which is when he replaces Rehnquist, does he go with a highly controversial choice, Clarence Thomas, for example, and pick a fight or not? And then do Democrats say, all right, we're replacing one conservative with another. It's not worth fighting on the Rehnquist nomination. Let's wait for the next one, and we'll see how that plays out.
Well, thanks to both of you for talking with us, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times.
And you can find all of NPR's inauguration analysis, news, and commentary at our website, npr.org.